Hi, this is Paul. You who sent this to me, I won't name you, but he's been really batting a high percentage of colonizing me lately. He sent me this, and wow, what an interview! I'm tempted to subscribe to the Substack just to hear the rest of it because it went so well. Why New Atheism Has Failed, Justin Brierley. Justin has kind of become a philosopher's stone here, whereby I did a video of his conversation. So he's on his book tour, and so he's talking about the same points to me, to Sky Gitani, to Louise Perry. But whoever he talks to, something is, maybe the philosopher's stone's a bad analogy, but something is revealed about them. And my video about his interview with Sky Gitani and my disappointment with Sky Gitani, this conversation with Louise Perry was, I thought, amazing and outstanding. And they dug up things and got to a level that actually, this was kind of where I wanted to go with Justin, but I don't really know that we got there. I think Louise took him deeper because, again, I am someone who has always believed. And I don't have a problem with believing because I was raised with this belief. And so it's easy for me. But for someone like Louise Perry, she's wrestling with this. And so she can say things and know things that I can't really know. So I wanted to play a portion of this, even just this 41 minutes. There's an 8-minute teaser on YouTube, and then there's like 41 minute teaser on her podcast, and then there's like an hour and 8 minutes on her Substack. That's sort of how she's arranging the freemium type deal. But I'm at minute 27, and that's where this thing really gets going, and it's amazing.
Be very good at coming up with a solution. And
Justin basically has just walked through all of the stuff that he's walked through pretty much about his book, introduced his theories about why New Atheism has failed, where we're at now, reintroducing the story, et cetera, et cetera.
Can't simply be, let's just start believing again, because it is like, how do you put that genie back in the bottle? But there's...
And so Justin and I just finished a conversation with the guy Sengstock, and Justin and I are kind of, I think, in sort of the same place that there needs to be another turning in Christianity. And I told Guy Sengstock, I said, the last time we sort of had a turning like this was sort of the Protestant Reformation. Now, let's keep going.
It's got to be something about, for me, it's about helping people to realize that we don't have to live in the story of reality that we've been sort of born into in Western culture, in 21st century Western culture, at least, that actually there is this other story that still has immense resonance and power once people discover it. And this thing that, as much as it's a very faulty and broken thing called the church, which has been the bearer of that story and still has the capacity to be a transformative agent for culture and society on earth. So that's kind of where I land. I don't have a lot of solutions, but I do believe that rediscovering that story that sort of ultimately makes sense of all those other stories people are trying to live their lives by is for me the ultimate key to how we make sense of where the world's gone.
I've made this argument around a few dinner tables and a few sort of panels when it's quite common for people who are critical of woke politics but are not religious to say something like, you know, it's not enough. Well, increasingly, I mean, there was a phase where there was just lots of criticism of wokeness, and now that's been said, and there's a more of a move towards saying, well, what next? We know that there's this meaning crisis. We know that young people are...
And I think Perry says it exactly right. Part of the reason I don't spend all my channel on, you know, reacting to wokeness is, yeah, it's there. It's said. It's out there. Woke... We've looked at this thing. We know what it is. It doesn't mean that it's resolved in the culture, but we know what it is. The real question is, okay, where do we go next? How do we talk to each other, the woke and the unwoke? How do we proceed? That's the real question.
Only miserable, all the rest of it. What? That's when it's quite common for people who are critical of woke politics, but are not religious, to say something like, you know, it's not enough. Well, increasingly, I mean, there was a phase where there was just lots of criticism of wokeness, and now that's been said, and there's a more of a move towards saying, well, what, you know, what next? What's a kind of, what's, we know that there's this meaning crisis. We know that young people are lonely, miserable, all the rest of it. What can we offer in their place? Because clearly people are finding meaning in politics to some extent, even if politics is quite a poor source of meaning ultimately. And I've had the experience a few times of putting up my hand meekly and saying, have you considered Christianity? You know, I'm not evangelizing, but I'm saying that it's probably the story that has been believed by more people, you know, throughout human history than any other, just in terms of sort of the raw numbers. And it has a remarkable ability to adapt itself to different cultures and sort of work in different registers. And so far that hasn't gone down very well. Because it's seen as sort of moving backwards, which of course it is.
But
is it possible?
Exactly. I think the reason you probably meet such incredulity around the dinner table is
that's the word,
is,
yeah.
Yeah, is because I think people think, well, not only are you potentially asking me to believe in something that just seems weird and outdated and irrelevant, but you're also potentially asking me to change the way I live because of it, you know, to make different decisions about my life. And I mean, that...
And I think Justin really gets at something there, that it's a commitment. So I mentioned... shoot, I wonder if I can do this. I mentioned this video, David Perel, again, another different person sent me this video. Not video, it's not a video, it's a podcast. I didn't know who David Perel was. I've never heard of this podcast. These are all sort of business, entrepreneurial types. So I'm sure some of you know more about this than I do. But in this podcast, he talks about his conversion. And he has this nice place in the podcast where he says, you know, Christianity is this weird thing in the culture because on one hand, everyone's a Christian because Christianity has so permeated the culture. And on the other hand, Christians are really hard to find. And what he means by that is this is obviously a focus-driven person. And he's like, most people don't really live out the Christian life. And fair enough. And I think, again, one of the things that I've been thinking about is nominal Christianity, cultural Christianity, the role that these levels play in the entire ecosystem of Christendom and how the gospel permeates and penetrates a culture. But, you know, what Justin Brierley says here is vitally important, that, yeah, Christianity makes demands and Jesus makes demands. And I know that a lot of nominal and cultural Christians sort of, you know, back away from the demands, but he makes demands and he bids you to, you know, like C.S. Lewis says, you know, you're rebels who need to lay down their arms. And that's just the gospel.
That was the remarkable thing, again, about your book, you know, if I may come back to it, which is the kind of solutions you suggested for how people might have a happier, more fulfilling sex life or relationships were kind of, you know, basically, well, don't just go with the flow with what culture says is the best way to find personal expression and freedom and everything. Let, you know, be choosy, wait. And, you know, Christianity sort of says that about, yes, you know, that issue. In fact, even more draconianly, it suggests you should wait until you're married and stick to the same person through thick and thin. That's a high bar in our culture to kind of call people to. But equally, it's not just that. I think there are all kinds of things that are a thoroughgoing Christianity will challenge people to. So it's no surprise to me that just presenting it as, it's not like just saying, have you thought of picking up this self-help book? Because I think in its true form, Christianity will be a very challenging road for someone to walk down, which is partly why I think almost the meaning crisis is going to have to get worse before a lot of people would even begin to consider it. I think it's almost like, as long as we've still got the luxury of kind of complaining about it, and but you know we've still, I don't know, got enough in our lives to sort of, that we don't have to make those kind of big sacrifices, I think a lot of people will choose to reject it.
And again, this mirrors in some ways my conversation with Guy. I just recorded that. I think I'm going to throw it in the No Wait, No Ads section of the membership and probably do the video I just made on the Amy on this tech conference that I got from a different person, not the person who sent me this. And I'll let the conversation with the guy sit for a couple of days, and then probably release that one a little later in the week.
Yeah. I also think, if I'm honest as well, it's just harder to make that change as an adult. I think there's a reason why, you know, most people, if they're going to be a Christian, they've probably made that decision.
And I think yes and no. And this gets back to what I talked about with Justin in terms of the weirdness. Part of the Christian ecosystem that's important is that there are cradle Christians and there are converts. Converts are often the radicals. They have experienced death, and now they're experiencing new life, and they keep Christianity weird. They go to Orthodox churches. They kiss boxes of relics. They want priests who are wearing long robes and have long beards. They are the ones who have basically said, you know, I don't care if I'm weird, I'm going to do this. Same with the Pentecostals. And there's a real connection. We've talked about this in the corner quite a bit, connection between Pentecostals and Orthodox. And so I think partly it's this, they're both reactive to modernity, and they don't mind either. They don't mind being reactive. And it's clear that there's definitely a market right now for reactive Christianity. And you see this not just with Pentecostals and with Orthodox. You see it with trad Catholics. You see it with culture warrior Protestants. There's definitely a market for reactive Christians today. And so I think, although Justin's point, and Louise is going to talk about that in a minute, Justin's point's important. The steep slope Christianity goes for people that they don't really care what you think. They're going after Jesus in the way that they believe they should, and they don't give a fig for what the culture says.
By their late teens and early 20s. That's not to say I haven't met plenty of adult converts. I do, and I'm surprised actually by how many I'm meeting these days, interestingly. But I think it just is harder to make a big U-turn in your life when you've reached a certain age, and it's you.
But it's also the case that, you know, for people like Justin and myself, cradle Christians, I can't remember if Justin converted as a young person or not, but anyway, married in the faith, children, church, all of that middle class Christianity sort of holds you in place. A lot of converts are single or divorced, and sometimes they're married, and that then, you know, causes some other things. But yeah, it's a complex picture.
It's harder to change the trajectory and the beliefs you have and the way the patterns of your life, you know, it's much, much more of a sacrifice. So I don't, I'm not at all surprised to hear that kind of response around the dinner table.
Most Christians were very positive in their responses to my book, but a common response I had was, why didn't you just go the whole way? Why did you say, I said, I think, wait 3 months into a relationship before having sex.
This part was very interesting.
Why not say wait before marriage? And actually, I can tell you that I did think, I basically, you know, because I wrote the book over the course of a year, a bit more, and I had a baby in the middle. So it was quite a long period of time. And I did basically persuade myself by the end of it that actually premarital sex is bad. I persuaded myself into the Christian position. I mean, it's not just Christian, but that position. Mm. And I thought of making that, and I thought of advising that explicitly in the last chapter. And then I spoke to my mum, who said, if you do that, that's the only thing anyone's ever going to say about the book. That's going to be the top line of every review, that, you know, that this is what this crazy lady has suggested. And so I didn't, I toned it down. But and indeed, my final chapter is Listen to Your Mother. So, you know, wow. I followed my own.
That's an amazing story, that waiting for marriage is so radical that if a book comes out, everything else she said in that book, which is fresh and startling and insightful, will all be overshadowed. I'm not sure that's true, because, you know, if you look on The Bachelor, there's always, you know, this one guy, he's waiting for marriage, and, you know, everybody's like, I grew up in a time and in place when that was the ideal and the norm that if you were a serious young Christian, you strove for, and it wasn't that uncommon.
And advice always in that regard. Advice. And she's right. I think it would have been so shocking, and it was intended to be, the book is intended for people who are coming, well, the book ends up, I wrote it for people coming from my kind of background, the sort of progressive secular background, who are interested in something more, less secular, more conservative. But interestingly, I also have heard from quite a lot of people who come from more fundamentalist religious backgrounds, not just Christian, also Muslim and Jewish women, who like it because it sits somewhere in the middle.
Yeah.
So I don't regret, therefore, soft peddling a little bit.
I mean, to some extent, you know, you weren't there to peddle a, you know, a specifically Christian ethic of sexuality. It happened that you came very close in the end in some of your conclusions. But even what you did suggest was quite radical, you know, in today's culture.
Yeah.
And so I was just pleased to read something that just felt so different, you know, to me. I mean, I should say, you know, the reality is, you know, any Christian who maybe did manage to do the unthinkable and wait until marriage for sex, that doesn't mean you're going to have the most wonderful sex life in the world and there will never be any issues. Obviously, you're subject to the same issues there.
So Justin's very much a moderate Christian. So he's looking over his right shoulder or he's looking over his left shoulder saying, I'm not you know, Nadia Boltz-Weber isn't going to come and wrestle me and, you know, get the purity rings to melt down into a vulva on stage with, look it up.
To the same issues that everyone else is. But I do think, from what I can tell, from what I've seen in research and I suppose anecdotally, I do just think that being an option on the table and taken seriously by Christians can have very positive effects. There are things about that. And for me, it's part of a much bigger picture than just the sex and relationships thing. It is about that re-enchanting of the world where we no longer treat, and this was what really struck me most about your book, is the way it laid bare the kind of way that the commodification of sex,
the way it laid bare that the disenchantment of sex doesn't make anyone happy, especially women,
of sex and relationships has just reached this kind of crazy point in our world now, and just how tragic it is that something that obviously has, for all the obvious sociological reasons but also deeply spiritual reasons, has been treated as a kind of really important thing that needs to be treated carefully. We need to get to a point where we kind of, it's not that we should go back to everything we used to sort of believe necessary or the way we used to act, but we need to re-enchant this, because it turns out this really is important. This is psychologically important for people. This makes a huge difference to the way they think about themselves. And you can't just treat it carelessly.
I think we should go all the way and just simply say premarital sex is a bad idea and Christians shouldn't do it. I think that's what we should say.
And as any other plaything. And that makes you sound really kind of conservative and reactionary these days. But actually, I've got teenage kids and a teenage daughter, and I just feel like I want them to grow up in a world where it's not treated this way, where there's something special about this. And yours is the kind of book that I am am passing on to my teenage daughter, because I just want her to know, whatever you're hearing from TikTok and Instagram and everything else that's in your life, this is a kind of sensible way of thinking about these issues that you just need to have in your life. So yeah, so a grateful father here to you, Louise Perry.
I think the vast majority of people think that deep down, and to stop talking about my book and talk about yours, you write about this fact that humans do seem to have this innate religious drive.
Yes,
like probably there's variation between individuals, and some people seem to have find kind of religious feeling more easily inspired in them than other people. But we seem to be kind of believing animals. And trying to suppress that doesn't seem to end well, either for individuals or cultures.
That's right. And as I say, I think the New Atheism sort of tried to sort of, you know, get rid of it, but failed spectacularly because all this other quasi-religious stories essentially, as I say, came on the scene and took over. I mean, I was seeing that there's a phenomenon on TikTok now called witch talk. And this is essentially people using TikTok to kind of do kind of incantations and hexes and charms and kind of get the universe on their side. And it's just fascinating because I think that even in our very technological age, you know, we're still using it to essentially kind of invoke supernatural means. So that, I think there's at one level, there just is that kind of supernatural stuff doesn't actually go very far. We're still fascinated by, you know, movies that deal in the supernatural. Horror movies, you know, have never lost their appeal.
Astrology. The number of millennial women who are passionate about astrology.
Yeah, absolutely. So all of that is kind of hovering around somewhere, you know, even in our post-Christian secular age, you know, the number of calls on the Catholic Church, for instance, for exorcism, especially around people who've got involved in the occult in various ways. It's interesting that stuff all still bubbles away. And on top of that, you've got then this other layer of quasi-religious kind of significance that people put into social justice causes and politics and everything else. So I do say that we're not any less religious. We're just religious about different things. There is this kind of religious instinct. And there's a kind of story-making kind of instinct, I think. I think it's got Jonathan Gottschall, who's a sociologist who talks about this, that humans have to have a story to live by. And we will end up creating something to make sense of our life, even if it's pretty poor, insubstantial kind of story. But we'll need something. We can't cope with the idea that we're actually just sort of bouncing around chaotically without a sort of narrative, you know, that makes sense of us. And I just think, the narrative, the stories have been increasingly insubstantial, or at least they're so varied and can't agree with each other in our culture that you know, they create this thing we call the culture wars. And I think that for me, the Christian story has got this relevance and resonance. You know, you talked about the fact it has been instantiated in many different places, times and cultures with remarkable success. And I just think there's something about that story that seems to work in culture. The question is sort of, again, it's back to that thing of, well, does it just work because it's a useful fiction? We happen to have stumbled upon a really good story. I think it's the other way around. I think it works because it's true.
And of course, Brierley says that because that is where some of this, it's from sort of the Jordan Peterson movement and I listed, so you have sort of, you have liberationist social justice, you have conservative social justice, and then you have evangelical salvationists. And evangelical, I include any Christian who basically is willing to defy modernity at one level to a considerable, a little bit to a considerable level. And conservative social justice, they tend to, oh, Christianity is a useful fiction. And of course, Justin's saying, no, he's more of an evangelical salvationist.
And I think that we're in an exciting moment where some people might be starting to realize that this story not only makes sense of their story, but is a real story. It's something that sort of makes sense. And one person I highlight, I'm sure you're familiar with him as well, Paul Kingsnorth in the book, is one of those interesting people who's been a storyteller all his life, a poet, an environmental activist as well at various points. And I think he was always looking for a story. He kind of, the teenage atheist phase kind of happened for him, but then went, and then he was into Buddhism, sort of looking for meaning kind of within. But he felt like he wanted to worship something. You know, he loved nature and had this reverence, this awe almost for nature. So he kind of turned to Wicca, interestingly, which is a bit out there, but he sort of was, you know, doing the stuff in the woods and, you know, worshiping nature. And he kind of realized in the end he was sort of doing a sort of weird pastiche of sort of New Age, quasi-Christian, you know.
So in my conversation with Luke and Sam, when we talk about LARPing, LARPing's not the best word, and I'm certainly not in any way trying to say anything negative about Orthodox and Orthodox converts. The point is what Jonathan Peugeot made to Stixenhammer 666 about this, that the traditions are broken. You can't really be a Druid. You can't really be. This is a new thing. You're sort of LARPing when you do this. And of course, Luke, who is, you know, Orthodox now, is just wrestling with these questions. And that video has to be taken within that spirit.
You know, pagan stuff. And it was fun and kind of. But he, again, he didn't do this full job. And in the interviews I've had with Paul, he was very surprised to find that it was the Christian story in the end that suddenly made sense of it all to him. It wasn't some, in a sense, sort of hugely intellectual conversion, though he's a very highly intelligent person. But it was just a sense that when he stepped into this story, when he kind of stepped into, in the end, the Eastern Orthodox Romanian Church, which he became part of, suddenly the liturgy, the story, the worship, sense of he said it felt like he had come home. He had sort of, this story suddenly made sense of all the searching that had gone on before. And I guess I look at a Paul Kingsnorth, again, someone who in their, I guess, late 40s came to faith, only in the last few years. And if it can happen to Paul Kingsnorth, I think, well, it could happen to quite a few other people, actually. There's a chance that religious longing might just find its home again in the greatest story ever told, as they say.
And so again, this is Brierley's book. This is very much where I'm at. And now Louise is going to come around and from someone in that space, and I think say some really helpful things.
So that's, again, some people have said I'm too optimistic because that sea of faith could wash in all.
No, Justin, you're not too optimistic. What we love about Justin is his sunny, open optimism. That is what makes Justin so important in the space that he inhabits. So don't change, Justin. You just keep being sunny and optimistic. I'm right there with you.
Other kinds of things, I guess I've just got a hope and a faith that it's the Christian story that'll eventually wash in and wash the other ones away.
Have you read Kingsnorth's essay? I think it was for First Things, Wild Christianity.
Mm, yes.
A year or two ago. Such a beautiful essay.
Mm, yeah.
And I mean, speaking personally, I'm kind of in that. I find Christianity very, very compelling intellectually and emotionally, but I find the metaphysics difficult.
Mm.
And I think it's because we've sort of had this fire.
I have spoken with so many people who have said that, maybe not quite as eloquently as she just did, but I have spoken. That is so where so many of you are at. And I think it is that transformation that we're going to see happen, where the plausibility structure is going to continue to evolve, and so many of you are going to find yourselves believing, and church will adjust and adapt and shift. And again, that's not going to be just one church that does it, just like in the Protestant Reformation. There's going to be multiple flavors of it, and we're going to see. Well, let's just let her keep talking now, because she's nailing this stuff.
A break. I think that if I had been born some centuries ago, I would have just believed completely. I would have been raised believing, and I would have just believed, and it would never have really been. I don't think I'm sort of a natural atheist. I think I would have embraced the faith that I swam in at the time.
There are very few natural atheists.
But given that I wasn't, it's now quite hard to really, you know, to sign up for all of it.
Yeah.
You know, not just the resurrection, but the heaven and you know, like there are so many supernatural claims within Christianity, which I just my disenchanted brain can't quite manage. But I do see many examples, including Kingsnorth and others, of people who have managed to jump that gulf. And actually, you know, I have friends who've had charismatic experiences in adulthood, or who have just I think Jordan Peterson is in this category, although I don't know in detail, just kind of gone to church, kept going to church, and eventually you fake it till you make it. That's
not exactly Jordan Peterson. He's not been going to church a lot. He's intellectually on his own path, but her perception there, and there it is. Remember with the video of Cosmic Skeptic, who basically says what Douglas Murray, I need to hear a voice. And so many people, remember, Pentecostalism is reactive to modernity, as is Orthodoxy. They're both deeply reactive to modernity. Modernity comes in and says, well, these things are not justifiable. And the Pentecostals say, justify this miracle. And the Orthodox says, who are you, youngster, to talk to us that way? I mean, that's those two traditions are reactive to modernity in a big way, and that's the strangeness of Christianity. But their middle is going to be filled in, and that's very much where
fairly common adult convert experience.
Yeah, I appreciate you being so honest about that, Louise, because I haven't heard you speak that very candidly at this point about your own sort of search here. I mean, if I may play quasi sort of spiritual advisor to you, though I hesitate to
please to
do that. I mean, what I totally get what you're saying. I think it's really difficult, I think, if you've been raised in a very kind of rational environment, to sort of, it feels like you're having to sort of sacrifice a part of your something to sort of buy into the sort of the metaphysics, as you say, of the whole thing. At the same time, I feel like, without realizing, we've almost been indoctrinated into a kind of materialist understanding of reality at the same time, without really being shown all the working out. I just feel like the more that I look, even at even on a kind of purely objectively scientific level at our universe, there's all kinds of aspects of it that seem to be, to me, crying out for an explanation beyond itself.
And this is where Justin's years in Unbelievable really pay off for him. He's sat there listening to the ping pong arguments back and forth for years. And he says, no, the universe is stranger than sort of a shallow modernist interpretation. Oh, I think everything just falls within this range of physics predictability.
I don't think the concept of God, per se, is at all one that you have to make a huge intellectual leap for. I think that the more I look at the nature of the universe, the nature of ourselves as sort of moral creatures, I don't think the God conclusion is necessarily one that is that hard to reach. I think it's the sort of the God in with skin on, Jesus, that is probably the next hardest gulf to cross. And I get that. But then that's one of those areas where I would say my first inclination would just be to get someone to go and read the Gospels and just see what happens, because I think you almost have to...
Justin is a good moderate evangelical.
Put yourself in to that story for the character of Jesus to suddenly start to potentially make sense. And obviously on the Christian worldview, I'm sure I'm not telling you anything you don't already know, but it is Jesus who basically shows us what God is like. God stops being an abstract proposition and becomes very real in that way. And again, I just find it incredibly interesting that when you do a bit of history, as sort of Tom Holland has done, you just see, firstly, gosh, this tiny little sect had this outsized influence on the whole of the world. And at the very center of this influence was this bizarre historical claim that the Jewish Messiah had been crucified and had then risen again. And against all of their theological expectations, his followers went around telling people and were willing to be martyred and crucified themselves on the back of it. And for me, I guess I kind of tentatively put these blocks together and say, well, look, I think I can build a kind of intellectual case for kind of that at least gets me so far towards those metaphysical claims. But there is a kind of point at which you're then going to have to say, okay, I'm either in or out on this. And I've maybe constructed a bridge close enough for it not to feel like I'm just leaving my brains at the door. But I could take a step here, a Kierkegaardian.
I really like Justin at this moment. I see Justin is careful. He's moderate. He's winsome. He's all of these things. And now he's building his bridge. And now I see here probably more than I've seen in other spaces, Justin sort of, I think, growing into where he wants to get to as being not just a referee, but an advocate.
And, you know, leap of faith and see what happens. And in my experience, when people have done that, they've been surprised to find, yeah, that suddenly the pieces do all slot together in a way I hadn't quite expected or whatever. I just think that you're never in the end going to get away from that sort of, it's about kind of transferring from one worldview to another, quite literally. And the way the Bible puts that is being transferred from the kingdom of darkness to the kingdom of light. So it's like you are putting down your materialist goggles perspective on the world and picking up this new way of looking at reality and the world. And hopefully you don't in the process become a complete weirdo, though some people probably do start to look and sound a bit.
Go ahead. Be a complete weirdo. I love weirdos. And I know some people complain about my penchant. Well, I'm going to just insult a whole bunch of my friends now. The reason I love this little corner is it's so full of weirdos. It's the same reason I love Living Stones. It's the same reason I love the homeless. I love weirdos. Weirdos are far more interesting than sort of non-player characters in the culture.
A bit weird to their friends, but it is a paradigm shift. And I don't know, that's the only advice I can offer to you. There is a good kind of foundation there that this is based on, but in the end, yeah, it's kind of like you're having to step from one thing into another.
I had coffee with a Christian friend recently who took like 10 years or something to gradually, she didn't have a charismatic moment, right? She just gradually transitioned to being someone who believed. And she said that, you know, look, the good thing about Christianity, and indeed many other faiths, right? But the good thing about Christianity is that it is comprehensive and internally coherent. And it's actually not like there's really an alternative. It's not like the scientism of Dawkins is comprehensive and internally coherent. It doesn't actually offer a real alternative. It doesn't tell us why we're here or any of that. It doesn't claim to. So it's kind of like either you just dive in face first and just say, okay, I'll just accept it and stop worrying about it so much. As the poster advises us to. So funny enough, her advice was basically, why don't you just believe in God and stop worrying about it?
And enjoy your life.
And enjoy your life, exactly. I mean, this is the beautiful thing in Francis Spofford's description of those posters, in Unapologetic, not Unbelievable, is your show, Unapologetic, yes, is his book, that he says, you know, what a thing to say to someone who's living a completely wretched life. Mm. Just stop worrying about it. Stop worrying about whether God exists. You know, actually, someone who's at the absolute bottom of the heap, the only thing they have is God, potentially. And to take that one thing away from them. I mean, one of the things that Christianity does very well, compared actually with many other, with possibly all other religious systems, is it offers comfort to the suffering, because suffering is built into the central story.
Mm. Yeah.
In a way that, say, a belief in reincarnation is, you know, it's not quite the same, is it? I mean, yes, there's the expectation of living again, but there's also the belief that in some sense your suffering is your own fault.
Yeah. And I like Spufford. I use him as an example, actually, along with people like Paul Kingsnorth towards the end of the book, of some of these adult converts, because he, although he'd sort of been raised in the Anglican church, he sort of rejected it sort of in his own sort of teenage atheism and just rebelling, I think, generally against authority and so on. But he kind of came back to it as an adult, because as his subtitle of his book says, it made surprising emotional sense to him. And one of the key insights I like from the book was that he said, because Christianity takes both the brokenness of humanity seriously, as well as its glorious capacity for good. But it does not shy away from the fact that we make an absolute mess of things, you know, the human propensity to F things up, as he calls it. But that it sort of meets us in both our brokenness and our glory. And that, I think, is a tremendous thing, because my problem sometimes with the secular humanist sort of thing is it's got this sort of sunny optimism. Oh, well, we'll all be all fine in the end, you know, if we just rally together and, you know, show our human spirit. Well, that's not very realistic. That doesn't happen. You know, that if the history of the early 20th century showed us anything, it's that, you know, people are pretty crap, and just encouraging them to get along with each other better is not going to make a blind bit of difference to that. And so I don't think, like, my humanist friends take the reality of human brokenness seriously enough, but I think Christianity does. I think it's right at the core of it, as you say, and the brokenness of our world. But it also has this tremendous hope that it can be redeemed, that there is, you know, the other side of the, you know, the humanist coin is the kind of nihilistic atheism, which sort of says, well, you know, there is no ultimate justice. There is no ultimate transformation or redemption. The world is a crappy place. And if you're at the bottom of the heap, you know, tough luck. Whereas I do believe in a story where those at the bottom of the heap will be vindicated one day. There will be a kind of justice that is done. And that,
it's right there in the book of Revelation. They cry out from under the altar.
It for me isn't just a kind of pie in the sky. I think it's a kind of, it meets my deepest sense of justice in this world, you know, being done by, if there is a God behind it, that it will be done in the world to come. So I in that sense feel like, yeah, the Christian story is holistic in that way. It's not just a kind of escapism or fantasy to make us feel better. I think it takes humans seriously. And the problem is, we sometimes get a caricature of it, obviously from new atheists, but even sometimes sadly from the Christian world as well, we get a very watered down, diluted sort of, you know, version. And I just don't blame people for rejecting that, because I would probably reject that too. But I think when people meet the real deal, when the Francis Buffords and the Paul Kingsnorths and, hey, maybe the Louise Perrys of this world meet it, I think it can suddenly feel like, yeah, this is something I could take seriously. This is something that could kind of give that sense of narrative and structure and purpose to life that I've been looking for.
I mentioned Church of England earlier as a somewhat troubled institution, and I have been to just about every flavor of Christian service at some point over the last decade or so. I actually did funnily enough, when I was at university and doing anthropology, I actually did fieldwork with the Moonies.
Oh, wow. Called.
So I've even been to Moonie services. Yeah. Amazing. And the interesting thing that we see at the moment in the Church of England in this country, and I think also this is true in other countries to some extent, is that basically the two styles of worship which seem to be doing best are either the highly traditionalist, so the Anglo-Catholic, so I believe as well in France and in the States, traditional Catholic worship is growing.
I told when I was in Australia, my friend Warren worships in the oldest cathedral, Anglican cathedral in Melbourne. And they, you know, that's Hillsong land, Australia. And so his highly liturgical, disciplined Anglican, I told him, I said, you know, culture rolls from California across the Pacific to Australia. Your day is coming. He said, I don't think so. I said, it's coming. Louise Perry's absolutely right. These are the hot areas. It's full-blown immersion, big sound, music, charismatic music or it's liturgy. These are the two spaces. If you're in the middle, kind of like Living Stones is, well, Living Stones is just so odd. It's just so odd. But those are the two, those are where things are happening. And Louise Perry nails it.
Partly because people have loads of kids, but also partly because it is attracting new converts. But then the other style of worship that's done, has proved popular in recent years in this country is the Holy Trinity Brompton style. So the kind of charismatic,
yeah,
pop music, all of this. And I've been to HTB style services and I actually quite like them. And our toddler loves them. Like they're great for families. They're really good. But I was just thinking when listening to you to talk about this, this kind of holistic understanding of suffering and brokenness, I don't see that very much in that kind of very, the way that a friend described it to me is it's kind of like primary colors theology.
She has a point, and Justin's going to correct her. I also know some Pentecostals do suffering very well because they have the guts to venture into really taking seriously seeking God for healing. And then when it doesn't come, a lot of people avoid miracles because they want to avoid the no, not getting a miracle. That's where the crisis is, almost always. The crisis isn't receiving a miracle. That's what you're looking for. That's the out. That's the deliverance. The crisis is a situation which, for all intents and purposes, is worthy of a miracle and one doesn't come. Again, I talked with Guy Sengstock about that in terms of wrestling with God.
Like extremely happy, extremely positive, you know, God, God loves you. It's like the top note, but it's not just the top note. It's the only note. There isn't really, I don't feel like there's space in that for actually the thing that attracts me to the faith. And maybe this is just because I'm neurotic, is the kind of the space to be extremely earnest in talking about.
I've been in Pentecostal spaces, many of the churches in the DR that I ministered to, they were, functionally much more that way. And, they lost children. I completely understand, and she's right, because there certainly are churches like that, but that is, in a sense, that's sort of the front. When you get down into it, that's where you'll see the suffering.
Suffering and difficulty.
Yeah.
But people clearly like that.
Yeah. I would agree with you. I think those are the two ends of the church that where there is life, it's happening there. I mean, what I would say about both of those, and I'll come to the issue about kind of the space for kind of, the desolation and solitude, or, that side of life, not just the celebration. I would say that what those two, on the surface of it, very different approaches to worship, highly liturgical, high church versus kind of very low church, drums and guitars and enthusiastic worship. What they have in common is that they're both sort of, they're both otherworldly in a way. They're kind of, they really take people outside of their mundane everyday experience. And if it's in the kind of theatrical Anglo-Catholic kind of tradition that just, does this very ceremonial, deeply poetic way of entering God's presence, or whether it's the Holy Trinity Brompton kind of like ecstatic kind of, hands in the air, sort of charismatic worship. I think what both of them have in common is that they take people out of the normal everyday, and they kind of show that there's a different world. There's something outside of their ordinary. I think you're absolutely right.
Right. They're reactive to modernity, and they break it, but in different ways. And then, of course, there are sort of high church charismatics, which can be really fun.
To say that potentially one of those celebration, joy, triumphalism, when life is obviously styles, can verge a bit too much on constant, much more than that. And Christianity, addresses that a great deal. I would say that even within those traditions, I have seen the flip side of that. I've seen, those modern charismatic churches do actually some kind of lament or introspection quite well as well. But I do think it's potentially a problem. I think to some extent that's where the Anglo-Catholic tradition, which always sort of confronts you in its liturgy with the good and the bad, and then the joyful sort of resolution of all that. That's what's one of the great things. What I've noticed, in fact, in speaking to a number of these secular intellectuals who are kind of maybe approaching Christianity, interested in it, is that they do tend to err, and maybe it's because a lot of them are on the more conservative side as well, they tend to err towards that Anglo-Catholic or, you know, Catholic or Eastern Orthodox kind of deeply rooted, ancient, mysterious kind of tradition. I think precisely because they feel like it launches them into something different to their everyday, and that's sort of what they're looking for. They're looking for a different story of reality. So I think you know, the advice that our mutual friend Tom Holland has often given me is keep Christianity weird. If you want to attract people like me, Justin, don't dumb it down, don't make it diluted, don't make it kind of, you know, prosaic thought of the day.
Keep it steep slope
A type stuff. Give me the angels and the weirdness and the, you know, because that's sort of what's ultimately aesthetically attractive, I think, to someone like Tom Holland. But I know lots of people who they just find it weird and discombobulating to be in an Anglo-Catholic sort of setting. It's going to be the HGB type thing that attracts them. But as I say, that's not necessarily a bad thing. It's just the fact we're all made differently. Well, I think the common denominator is it's like, it's a kind of all-in thing. It's like, if we're just in this lukewarm middle, I think people are going to reject that, because I can get just, you know, tea and cake down at the golf club. I don't have to turn up at church on a Sunday morning to
you don't have to mumble
that
into your hymn sheet as well. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I completely agree with you about that. That sort of that otherworldly aspect being attractive, and even though it's completely different styles. Anyone listening who's never been to an Anglo-Catholic or a high church service, I'd really recommend going to an All Souls service. Because I've been to All Souls at St Bartholomew the Great in London a few years running, and just found it so beautiful.
And it's very interesting.
Another you mentioned, world, exactly. Yeah.
You mentioned that at the time of recording, it's still in the process of being sorted, so it might not happen. But I'm planning on a book launch actually at St Bartholomew the Great. The vicar is Marcus Walker. And I know him. We were sort of contemporaries at university, and he it is the oldest church in the City of London. And I interviewed him once or twice about it, and he would say, you know, COVID notwithstanding, that actually it has been interestingly attractive to a lot of millennials, you know, not the age range you would expect to be turning up for a very traditional Anglo-Catholic service. But I think there's part that there is something, I think, especially among young people, that is hearkening for something different and mysterious. They don't necessarily want, you know, a church version of a Coldplay concert and, you know, a TED talk. They want something that feels, you know, different and mysterious and otherworldly in that way. And I think you get that probably with bells and whistles on it at St. Bartholomew the Great. So I'm looking forward to being there. Details yet to be announced to talk about whether this very ancient story and ancient church could have relevance for modern people. So yeah, interesting overlap.
My only, Marcus, if you're listening, please can you introduce a crash? Because trying to take one of the things that is very attractive about the HTB style is they always have crushes, pretty much. And also no one really cares if your toddler is screaming because it's so loud you can't hear them anyway.
Yeah.
Whereas taking a toddler to a very austere sort of service is fairly excruciating for the young.
And what Justin's about to say is exactly right and warms my heart.
Only one.
Yeah, absolutely.
Racing around trying to stop them knocking over the candles.
I feel your pain, and there are, you know, hundreds of parents all over the country probably have been exactly the same position. Fortunately, if my view is that, you know, a church should be able to cope with a screaming toddler once in a while. Otherwise it's not the church for me. The church at its glorious best is a bit messy, full of normal humanity. It's got glorious, aesthetically pleasing moments, but it also...
And it's got the Freddie and Paul show.
So it has all those, a bit of mumbling into your hymn sheet and bad coffee at the end of the service. And that's okay, because it's still one of the few places, I think, in our culture where you can get a bit of genuine community. And my hope is that it will always continue to do that in a culture where we're increasingly isolating ourselves from each other through technology. It feels like we need something like the church to that brings people together again.
One of my regular listeners commented recently on the fact that he it's an intellectually disabled woman who goes to their church who recently was confirmed, and he and his wife made her a cake and other people also sort of did celebratory things for her, and she was so thrilled, and it occurred to him that probably there's nowhere else in her life where she receives that degree of kindness and hospitality, because she's otherwise a very solitary person.
And likewise,
Guy was talking about family and church, and that's right,
like there just isn't really a replacement.
And in my I'm married to a church minister in our denomination, and we often say the church feels kind of unique, because when we look at our congregation, you might have a 90-year-old next to a 3-year-old, and they might be talking to each other afterwards, you know, over the coffee and cake. And it's very hard. There's very few places where that happens any longer, you know, where you get that intergenerational, that, you know, people as well from very different backgrounds, because, I mean, church can inevitably, you know, be somewhat reflective of its local demography and everything else. But at its beating heart, I think the church has always been a place where actually the master and the serf kind of both come and find themselves on equal ground, you know, that and there's a sort of a place in which there is a, you know, this idea of this unity and diversity, neither slave nor free, male nor female, Jew nor Greek, as St. Paul put it. And that's what the church is supposed to look like, this kind of, you know, diverse place where different people meet around a shared unified thing. And that is the dream. It doesn't always happen in reality, but most churches I know give it a good shot. And as I say, I'd rather they would giving it a try than them not existing.
All right, that's a great note to end on. Let's talk.
Great, 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 great conversation. So much good stuff in it. So actually, I looked at it, and the way time worked on Pocket Casts. So I think this was the whole conversation that's available on her RSS feed. I'll put a link via Pocket Casts in the description here. Great conversation, and I'm just looking at the rest of a bunch of other things on it thinking, oh, I got to pay more attention to her podcast. I think she's really sharp. I think her finger is really on the pulse. She's seeing it well. She wrote a really exceptional book. Once I get the puppy thing sorted out, I should reach out, because right now it's the middle of the night in the UK. I should reach out and have her on and have a conversation. So awesome. So, yeah, look it up. Listen to the whole thing. Leave a comment.